check and everything, that everything will be fine. It'll be looked after. They're going to get their patent. They're going to get rich, and that's the inventor's dream. That's not true. And it's not the fault of the patent attorney, although there's some out there that I must say I'm a little ashamed of. I'm even ashamed of some of the patents that I got for people. But I'll tell you later that I lived up to the patent attorney's oath when I got those patents. So how could I be wrong? I'll talk about that later. So the inventor's dream is that the patent attorney will look after everything. Well, in many cases, when you have a drop-dead simple invention, a bottle which has ribs in the sides and a star pattern in the base, you give him the bottle, you write it up, and she'll draft a perfectly good patent, and you're not needed. But in something that's as complicated as the field that you're all concerned about, the inventor has to educate the patent attorney. So you walk in the door, and the first thing you'll say is, tell me your story. Because a patent attorney is a journalist. He writes down your story. He doesn't fix the invention. He doesn't change the invention unless he's working overtime. But he writes down your story in the clearest possible manner. And I've enjoyed in my life writing down the story of hundreds of inventions and getting it clear so that I understand them, and I know when I understand, and then if I do understand, the patent is clear. And if I don't understand, the patent will not only not be clear, it'll probably not be valid. So your patent attorney has to understand the process of the invention. And the first thing he'll do is he'll suggest to you that you do a pre-filing patent novelty search. Now, the purpose of the search is nominally so you don't waste your time. Frankly, if you have a good ideas are thought of by lots of people. So if you have a good idea and you do a search, it's quite likely you'll find the good idea. But if you have a silly idea, you're almost guaranteed that you're going to be able to get a patent, because it won't be in the prior art. So the attorney does the prior art search nominally so you're not wasting your money. But he has another reason. He has to get smart fast. So he's busily reading these patents at your expense, $600-$800. You pay a searcher $700 or $800 or $1,000 to do the search, and then you pay the attorney to read this prior art and tell you what you've done that's new. Actually, you could have paid for the search yourself and spent a little time on it. If you do the search and you find your idea, it's over. If you do the search and you don't find the idea, it's never over. Because someone can find your idea later, and even though you get a patent, the patent's invalid. So finding out what's new early to save yourself money is very important. But the attorney wants to get those prior art patents because he's reading up on them and he's making a list of all the jargon. So the next time you meet with him, golly, you learn fast. I mean, you suddenly understand a lot about this. So not all patent attorneys will tell you this, but I actually have said it to people. You can always get a patent. Always. If you reduce what you're patenting to a trivial detail. If it's as trivial and as elaborate that the examiner looks at it and says, geez, I'm never going to find this if I keep searching, he'll give you a patent. But what's it worth? That's the note. It's not worth anything if it's a trivial patent, but you have a patent. So the attorney, when he's looking at the prior art, he'll tell you, well, you can get a patent. No, the bottom's been done before. The ribs have been done before. Even the little neck here has been done before. But you have an asymmetrical neck. So I think that's a novel feature. I think we can probably get a patent on that. Now, he's going to make $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000. So you're not going to get a patent attorney to say, this is a trivial feature. He's not going to bring it home to you because he's going to leave it up to you. And this is the problem, is that the inventors walk in with this dream. but they don't pay attention to understanding what they should know about the patenting process. And that is thousands, hundreds of thousands of patents that are issued every year that aren't worth the money. There's a 500,000 applications filed every year at the U.S. Patent Office. They linger for years. Some of them drop by the wayside. Right now, 250,000 get issued for patents. But of the 500,000 patents, there's probably not 25,000 that are really valuable ideas. And there's a danger that even amongst those are not well drafted. So your attorney is there, and he has a commitment. He has a commitment. I will try and get you a valid patent of the broadest scope that you deserve. Is that reassuring? You got to think about it. Because he's going to try and patent something that has never been available to the public before. So his target is to get a statement of monopoly that doesn't interfere with anything that existed before. That's called a valid patent. And if your patent is on some crooked or bent way of doing something that nobody cares about, you get a valid patent if it's well drafted. So that's the inventor's oath that you can make. I'm going to get you the broadest possible patent, a valid patent, the broadest patent you deserve. But doesn't mean it's worth the money. So the problem of the prior art, and it's not the attorney's fault, the prior art constrains what you can patent. So you can ask your patent attorney, will it be worth it? I think you'll probably, after some prodding, that's for you to decide. So many attorneys, so many inventors don't ever ask the question, will it be worth it? And whether it's worth it depends, is the invention a good invention that people will want to use? Can it be built at a price they're willing to pay? Are there existing alternatives in the market that are already just as good? Fail on any one of those and the patent is worthless. By the way, I didn't mention patents, did I? That's all about the invention. It's for the inventor to decide whether the invention is viable in the marketplace. Oh, you don't need a patent to go into the marketplace. I've had people think, oh, I have to have a patent to go into the marketplace. No, you go into the marketplace, you be careful not to step in any cow patties. Don't use this special twist-off cap here. It's got a patent on it. Just stay away from other people's patents. But you don't need a patent to go into business. You could go into business and take the heat of what happens if you succeed. Now, if you don't succeed, you don't need a patent. The reason you get a patent is if you succeed, somebody might copy you. Now, before you get copied, you have that wonderful world of a natural momentary monopoly. And what does that mean? It means you can charge what the customer's willing to pay. And if they don't know what it costs, they'll pay an arm and a leg sometimes for a drug or for something that's really convenient. What was Apple selling their original iPhones for before the people in Taiwan and Singapore and South Korea all started to make these cell phones? And now we now know that a cell phone doesn't have to cost $800. Because there's other people who are making cell phones at a lower price, and Apple is coasting on their prestige. But it won't last long. They're going to have to reduce their price. That's what happened to BlackBerry and RIM. They had their little machine with the thumbs, and people kind of liked it, but other people came out with better products. And the only way that that BlackBerry could compete in the market is they had to lower their price because there were cheaper products available. The purpose of a patent is so you don't have to lower your price. It's to keep out the competition. You're trying to get a monopoly. So your job as the inventor is to invent an invention that works, an invention that is commercially relevant, an invention that's not already redundant because of what's done in the marketplace. And the patent isn't going to make the invention succeed. The patent enhances profitability if the invention succeeds. And you have to provide your patent attorney with a description on how to bake the cookies in the oven. Did you have a question?
If you did go the route where you didn't get a patent and it became successful, could you then patent it?
Or there's a deadline. There's a deadline to get a patent. Canada, United States, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea allow the inventor to talk about it for 1 year, and then it's too late. But everywhere in the world, if a stranger talks about it publicly, or writes about it publicly, or uses it publicly, it's over. Because as soon as the invention is available to the public, anywhere in the world, in any form, at any time in history, you can't get a patent on what was available to the public. And you often hear that you can't get a patent on something that's obvious. And that's really just a subcategory of available to the public. What's available to the public is everything that's been talked about or described or done, and anything that's obvious based on that. You can't get a patent on anything that's been made available to the public, subject to the exception in those countries that if the inventor talks about, it's called a grace period. Warning, this is not the grace period that was available before March the 16th, 2013. The American first to invent system guaranteed that you could wait 1 year after your invention. If you filed within 1 year, you wouldn't be prejudiced by any public disclosures because you'd invented it. So you were tested as of your date of invention. But under the new system, as soon as anyone either files or discloses your idea publicly, you've lost your rights to get a U.S. patent. And if you disclose your invention publicly, you've lost your rights in Europe, you've lost your rights in many countries around the world. Now, the U.S. Patent Office has a special procedure for cold fusion. Is that what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Cold fusion inventions, LENR inventions. Normally of those 500,000 applications, there's no way they could ask everybody, oh, by the way, prove your invention works. So they have a rule. They only ask you to prove your invention works if there's doubt. And the examiner is supposed to raise the issue of doubt based on some evidence. Perpetual motion, anti-gravity, universal cure for cancer. All these things are justify the examiner saying to you, excuse me, could you please prove that this really works? And they add it to the list, cold fusion. So you get these letters from the examiner, which look incredibly ugly because they rant and rave about cold fusion being a fraud. It doesn't mean, although it may be true that the examiner's made his mind up. By the way, Carl Sagan made this statement, extraordinary claims merit extraordinary evidence. And I started to think about that. Really, he's saying, if I don't believe your claim, I'm not going to believe your evidence. And so we do have people out there that take that attitude. They just won't believe the evidence. And there are examiners like that that won't believe the evidence. But they only have to shift the burden to you by saying, look, this is a cold fusion invention. There's enough doubt about cold fusion. Please prove it works. Now, how do you prove it works? The best way is to take your patent disclosure, the story that you wrote up and gave your attorney. You take it over and you give it to a researcher at an institution, SRI, Mike McCoubry, or somebody who's got status, and you say, Mike, follow the recipe I have here for baking cookies, and tell me if it makes cookies.
Wrong. This is what we did, and we didn't got the patent.
Well, I hear you, and this is why I got interventions like that when David Nagel was running the thing. Because people have had a lot of personal experiences, and they don't really, they have had bad luck with a bad examiner, or they
it's
don't...
It's not bad luck. It's that they don't describe what's submitted.
Let's say this for the
law says that a person submits a patent application, that is what is supposed to be discussed in the response. And yet the standard response of the U.S. Patent Office is to say to any invention, that is what Pons and Fleischmann did. They never read the applications. They never respond to the applications, even when asked.
Mitchell, are they still doing that now?
Well, that's the issue, and poor Mitchell. Mitchell is not alone. There are other people that file patents claiming that they have a cold fusion effect taking place, and there are examiners out there that behave, in my view, irresponsibly. They're only supposed to raise a doubt, and then the burden is on the applicant to prove it works. And I described a procedure that would succeed in proving it works, and before ICCF 18, I wrote with Duncan, I wrote to the U.S. Patent Office and suggested that maybe they'd like to have a seminar like they had at CERN, in which people knowledgeable would come in and speak to the examiners and say, look, this cold fusion thing is real. They didn't want to hear that. They sent me back a letter. They wrote back saying, make no mistake, the Patent Office is open to grant patents for cold fusion if the invention works and is useful, if it's well described, and if the claims focus on something new. But that's the Patent Office Senior Directorate giving me a reply. But there's thousands of examiners in the Patent Office, and a good number of them are jerks. But what can I say? I apologize 100 times over, Mitchell, that you've been treated as...
Everyone in the room has been treated this way. This is not just me,
but,
okay?
But
we've had John Dash and myself go to the Supreme Court, and the fact is the Patent Office is willing to lie. And how do you deal with people who are willing to lie? We submit evidence. In fact, after the Patent Office sent you that letter that they would consider cold fusion, they turned down my application for the demo that we did in 2003 on the Fusor. It wasn't that I filed later, I filed then. So people saw it, 500 people saw it, we sent lots of evidence. They don't respond to it. That's the problem. You're telling people what to do, but they don't understand that the Patent Office is not interested. They will not respond honestly, and they will not respond to the record.
So in Melvin Miles' case, in the paper that I did for ICCF 18, he has a claim at the end, having claimed an arrangement as having a certain catalytic effect chemically. He says, and furthermore, I claim it for generating unexpected or unexplained excess energy. And that patent went through. Now, maybe the attorney kind of pulled the wool over the eyes of the examiner, or maybe the examiner followed the rules in the Patent Office Manual of Practice that says if you can demonstrate one point of utility, the fact that the inventor claims that it has other uses shouldn't be challenged. I can't defend the treatment that Mitchell's received.
Could I ask a question, sir?
Prove that it works. If you mention cold fusion, you're going to be hit by it.
Thank you.
Loudly.
Thank you for mentioning the list of things that you're not supposed to get patents on. Most people don't even think that list exists. You should have mentioned what else is on the list, which includes stupid things like warp drive and time machines and invisibility cloaks. Okay, I hold the patent on invisibility cloaks, all right? And that was in 2012 that they granted that patent. I'd be happy to tell everyone personally, not in this form right now, how that happened. But doing a demo, inviting the patent office to come down and see it, was incredibly important to make them understand it was reduced to practice and the utility issue was resolved.
If you demonstrated that it works, then you got over that hurdle.
What I'm saying is maybe something changed in 2012 with the Patent Office. Obviously, folks are now getting cold fusion patents. We're trying to understand, has the tide turned? That's the real issue. I don't know the answer to that.
All right. By the way, if you slip something past the Patent Office, your patent is still subject to the furnace of litigation, and every decision made in the Patent Office is revisitable in court in litigation. And the attorney acting for the other side, if you don't have a complete disclosure in your patent document, he'll make sure the jury hears about it. And that's grounds for rendering the patent unenforceable. So your patent attorney may warn you if he knows all the rules. They don't all know all the rules. That you'll be asked to prove it. You may not be asked to prove that your disclosure is enabling, although that can be raised by the examiner too, but in litigation, the defending attorney will.
Is there a time limit?
For what?
For a review?
In the patent office, you're given an examiner's objection with a deadline of 3 months to reply without paying an extension fee, and you're allowed to purchase extensions up to a total of 6 months. But the statute says if you don't answer within 6 months, your patent application is abandoned. Now, that means that people go through a cycle of answering the examiner, and after the second procedure, the examiner will announce, by the way, this is final, but you can pay money and buy your way out of final. So you can cycle by paying more money for continued examination. You can do 1, 2, 3, 4 years. Sometimes the examiner will take 8, 10, 12 months. I just had a woman, a lady who works at home, I don't object to that, and has had a baby. And she took a long time every time we requested continuing examination. The patent office has a rule. If the examiner uses up too much time, the patent term is extended. And the first time in my life I fell over, the patent finally was allowed with a two-year extension of time because she'd taken such a long time. And then there's the Selden patent that was filed in 1879, and the attorney that filed it knew how to delay. Delayed it 18 years. It was a patent on a gasoline automobile. And then the patent issued, and he turned it over to a syndicate that started suing people, and one of them they sued was Henry Ford, and he said, I'll be goddamned if I'm going to pay. So he litigated that patent, and he got it narrowly construed so it didn't cover him. But then he bought the patent and announced to everybody else, I think this patent is valid after all. Therefore, everyone had to pay into the pool. That, by the way, the Selden patent was filed by a patent attorney. He knew how to string it out for 18 years. Up until 1994, patents ran 17 years from the date of grant. And there were submarine patents that lingered in the patent office 8, 12, 15, 20 years. When I was a kid back in 1976, color picture television patents were still in litigation in Canada. And they were under the rule that the patent runs from when it's granted. All right. You as the inventor are responsible for commercial viability, not your patent attorney, and don't expect them to tell you, that's a stupid invention, or, God, I hope you don't waste your money on this. He's not. Now, why would you get a patent? And the answer is, one reason is publicity. Because investors want to know that you have a patent. Well, if you can pull the wool over an investor's eyes, you'll spend the $12,000, $15,000, or $20,000 of your precious research money on a patent. But if you think mega corporation is going to be impressed with your patent, you've got another thing coming. Because they're going to send it down to legal, legal's going to read it, and they're going to say, this patent is crap. Don't pay the guy any money. Okay. So don't think you can pull the wool over the eyes of a sophisticated company. Now, the object of the patent is to exclude competitors, and it's useless if there's already something that works. It's useless if it's too expensive. It's useless if people don't care. You better have a plan for a business that would work, even if you don't get a patent. Because a patent doesn't make your invention work. People don't buy books because they're copyrighted. Have you ever seen a bookstore? A big sign? New! Copyrighted! A big arrow pointing at a book. Would you rush in and buy that book? And your invention could be outmoded. You know, you invent the ballpoint pen, and then a couple years later somebody invents a felt marker. Yeah. So, and there's nothing you can do about that. I mean, it's a different class of invention. So, it's for the inventor to assess whether it's worthwhile. You can ask your patent attorney, will my patent protect me from competition? That's a really hard question to answer. And all he can say is, your rights are described by the list of items in claim one. Go home and read it and ask. If you were a competitor, could you make something that avoids being within the description of that claim? Every inventor should go home and meditate on that for 100 hours, because that's what drafting claim one is all about. It's drafting a claim with no loopholes. And frankly, most claims have loopholes.
I'd like to add one thing to
sure.
that. I've told people who are involved in getting patents, and patents are licensed to coach. They tell you where the fish are.
Well, you give away your idea to the public on the premise you're going to get a monopoly back, but the value of your monopoly is no bigger than the idea that it protects, and get value for what if the patent is properly drafted.
Say Coca-Cola.
What?
Coca-Cola. I gave an example.
Coca-Cola is not a patent.
No. They kept the formula.
Secretly.
Yeah, but that's all about sizzle. That's all about story. Connor, you all dupes living in a universe of advertising. Do you believe all the... Really, is Coke different from Pepsi? Or Crown Cola?
Of course.
Or Kick Cola? If Coca-Cola costs twice as much as Pepsi, who would buy Coke?
The people that love Coke, they
wouldn't pay twice as much. My very last point, and then I'm going to
gotta drink Zevia.
Hey, Nikita, you need to figure out Coca-Cola.
Listen up. Don't despair. Watch for a new arrangement that makes a difference. If you think it's new, go and see an attorney. Check it out. It just might be the invention of the century. Thank you. Now comes the best part, because I know you all want to go home. Let's have just a one or two questions. Yes.
Does speculative fiction invalidate, does that count as prior art, science fiction?
Do you know, an idea is out of the bag if it discloses enough that people could make the invention work. And the best example is the agribusiness and Sacrobarty case in the Supreme Court. The invention was trickling water over the floor of the barn so that all the shit would slowly be washed away. And the Supreme Court said, not a new idea. Hercules did that in the stables of some king. So they quote Hercules. Good question.
Yeah. International patents in reciprocity.
Well, when you file in the United States, you only have to file in every country. But there is an international system called the Patent Cooperation Treaty, but it's not about patents. It's called Patent Cooperation Treaty. It should be called the Patent Application Cooperation Treaty. And if you enter the Patent Cooperation Treaty, you get 30 months to choose your target countries. But then you have to go to every one of these countries. And most of these countries have absolute novelty. The Americans finally went off. It wasn't just about first to file. It was also the novelty standard. You know, before March the 16th, 2013, a talk like this was not prejudicial to your patent rights in the United States. But today, I may have 1 year to talk about my wonderful ideas for this bottle, but not... No one in the world can now have an asymmetrical pitch on the bottle because I made it available to the public.
Can you kindly tell the folks about the provisional patent?
Well, that's one of the most valuable aspects of the patent law. You file a first application that reserves your rights around the world. You reserve your rights in the United States Patent Office for 1 year. At the end of the year, at month 10 or 11 or 11 and a half, you can rewrite the story. That's the last time you can change the story. When you do your final application at the end of the provisional year, you convert it to a regular filing, the story is frozen. And trust me, I've had tears on my face when I realized I didn't say something when I filed the final application. And 2 years later, an examination, I'm searching for a word, and I'm reading, and it's not there. I screwed up. See? So the provisional is you first file it, then you're not prejudiced by talking about it, and you're not prejudiced by other people talking about it. But you have 1 year to upgrade the story. And if you have multiple ideas, you file a second provisional and a third. And Randall Mills has filed 25 and 30 provisionals because he goes down to his patent attorney once every 2 weeks and he gives them the latest story about what we cooked up here at Black Light Power. And they just file another one for $200 or $400. I don't know what the price is for him. But it's low cost to file a provisional. But at the end of the year, you assemble, concatenate, you assemble all of those filings into one document.
Speaking of Randall Mills, I recently read one of his patents where he describes his invention of every permutation of some large number of chemicals in, 50 different ways. So he's trying to obfuscate the one that actually works, or that he's using, I assume. Does the patent office actually accept that approach?
Actually, ironically, the Viagra patent was recently invalidated in Canada on a new grounds. And that was, Viagra was claimed, but they never pointed out in the story what was the best way to do the invention. The first claim in the patent claimed like 4 million compounds. And then you add a detail or two. So it wasn't until claim 6 that you got to Viagra, which really works. And the Supreme Court got all in a fluff about this. This is too hard to read. We don't know what the special invention is here. And this is in Canada. It could happen in the States. If you obfuscate enough, the patent can be condemned for being indefinite. Yes?
In my experience, often it is not very difficult to get novelty in a patent, but it's rather more difficult to get non-obviousness for novelty step. So your invention can be new, but it lacks of
I'll give you an example, my best example of obviousness. Let's assume you're the day that Bombardier rolled out the Skidoo. It's the first disclosure in the world of a Skidoo. And you say, my God, I can pull a sleigh with that. You rush down to the patent office and you file a patent application for a Skidoo pulling a sleigh. Won't work. It's obvious. Okay? Now, what is obvious? That's a gray area in the patent law. You just have a lot of litigation over that. But obvious is supposed to prevent you from getting a patent that was really functionally available to other people because it wasn't hard to think of. So obviousness is a big problem. Now, there are some of you from Italy. Italy did not examine patents up until 2 years ago, and Rossi got one of the last unexamined patents.
Unexamined?
He has a pending application in the U.S. Patent Office right now, and I'm not going to comment on it until the examiner does, but I know there will be an interesting response to what the examiner has to say, because that patent has a lot that you could say about it. Okay, are we getting down? Am I the last one to speak tonight?
Well, would anyone else like to speak?
Or do you want to have a panel? Or what is it you want to do?
We have an open floor. If somebody would like to say something about patents or policy.
This
or
could be the
legal comment.
Yes.
I am Italian.
Yes.
So, about 4 years before, about threat to constitution, but we never wrote constitution, and moreover, to be accepted, this patent was written a procedure to improve the ability to decompose the south glass from ash. So, and we wrote sometimes energy needed to keep a catalyzer. I don't know if it will work very effectively. So we get patent. But if you wrote constitution, we never did.
It's like a Greek.
Italy or US?
No, European. European.
There are many patents issuing in Europe. They
but
have
we
a
never use a constitution name.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they will be okay. It's like a.
But there's a class in the European classification for cold fusion inventions.
No, we never use cold.
I know you didn't. And you got it through, and you didn't have trouble, and it was a good idea. But the Europeans are more flexible than the Americans.
That's correct.
I mean, Patterson got patents
got
in Europe.
Got patent in China, never got a patent in the States.
Okay, well, China, I don't know, I can't evaluate China. By the way, here's a little anecdote. Fleischmann and Pons got a patent in Europe. It got challenged.
Yeah.
Who challenged it?
Patterson.
And they walked away.
Who challenged it?
Patterson challenged the European patent obtained on the invention by Fleischmann and Pons. But somebody owned that patent at the time, and rather than spend the money to defend it, they walked away and the patent lapsed for not defending it when challenged. It's a very strange story. I don't know the full story. Yes?
As this cold fusion gets more and more recognized, there's going to be more and more people taking a look at it. What do you recommend in the event of box patents?
What?
A box patent.
What is box patents?
Box. Where corporations or other people that have significant funds or interests take aspects of your patent, make an application for improvement, and they actually end up boxing you in, restricting your ability to work on your own patent, and they have effectively is neutralized.
That's nothing new.
No, it's not nothing new, but I'm just saying this is a new thing where this could be exposed to.
No, this is the procedure of improvements. Even though an improvement infringes on the original concept, a person can get a patent. If I invent a bicycle with wooden wheels and you invent spoke wheels, you can get a patent on a bicycle with spoke wheels. But I have the patent on bicycles. No matter what kind of wheel. You can't build bicycles with spoked wheels, even though you invented spoked wheels. But I can't build a bicycle with spoked wheels because you have a patent on spoked wheels. So it's always possible to get an improvement on the basic idea. And AT&T and Xerox made a great run of it over a long period of time by continuously improving the product. If you got the first patent on the Xerox process, it took 30 seconds to form an image. It's not going to work. And even if you can form an image in 2 seconds, and someone else has an image that can be formed in a quarter of a second, trust me, Toshiba, if they have the process for forming an image in a quarter of a second, they've got a winner. And then all the inkjets and the laser jets that came in, they displaced the selenium drum. So there's always improvements. Some of them are dominated by the original invention, and some of them bypass it. An inkjet printer bypasses the xerography process. So you're always vulnerable to somebody making a better idea. Sometimes your patent will dominate them. Sometimes your patent will not dominate them. It's a kind of a loophole, but it's ex post facto. It comes from other people inventing. And it's one of the justifications for the patent system. It encourages people to invent around.
So the way to avoid that or to defend against that is to use a picket fence. So you keep on filing out new things around people away from core invention as much as you can.
From the original disclosure?
From the original.
If it's described in the original.
You make the improvement.
Well, even if it's not in the original disclosure, but it relates to how you're doing something. So in other words, if you have a manufacturer, you have an invention, and then you have a manufacturing process that either improves or describes more of what you're doing, you're able to keep pushing out so that someone can't invade the area that you're trying to.
But that's a job for the inventor to do the inventing. It's not a job for the attorney.
That's right. It's a job for the
wording it is the attorney's job.
Ways of doing it and pushing it out so that.
Yeah. Inventors don't trust you.
It does cost money.
If you're in the science for $25,000, that means a lot. And if you're spending all your money, you just trying to invent yourself before you can get it.
So the observation is here. If you need the $25,000 to complete your invention, it may be justifiable not to file an international patent, maybe not even to file in the U.S., your best value for your money is a U.S. patent application. Just file in the U.S. and don't file anywhere else. And don't rush it through. Don't rush it through. Let it sit there. You're going to get smarter. You can't change the story. If you can change what you think, you choose.
Why not?
You get an extra beyond the 12 months, you get an extra 18 months, but then you're going to have to pay $5,000 a country.
Only one. You at least preserve your rights.
Well, for $5,000, file a PCT. If you think you're going to sell your invention to a big corporation, file a PCT. Maybe they'll clean up the claims. They can't change the story, but maybe they'll clean up the claims. But listen, before we finish and wind this down, Mitchell, you started and you're on your feet now. And come, please stand here. Well, I want Mitchell to have it clear. I will tell you, Mitchell started filing patents in 1990. He's been filing 1989, and he has. Got one yet?
We got two design patents. We've got several. The first one actually we filed over Lady Nine.
So Mitchell hasn't gotten a patent through. And I find it hard to believe that the patent office has singled him out for harsh treatment, but that could well be what's happening. I would not like to think that everybody who files for an invention relating to cold fusion will be treated the way Mitchell's atrociously. I will say about
same thing with all of them.
That's right.
You've had the same experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, there's a big.
And we were responding on time, and we had all the financial resources needed, so we were not limited with our financial resources and the time that we spent, and we were responding immediately.
So, and I bet you fully replied.
And we did the application in SRI, and they got even better results than ours with regards to reproducibility.
So here's the procedure. The examiner gives you a final office action. If you want to remove finality, you pay a new filing fee. But let's say you come to the end of the road, you can't change the story, but you can change the claims. Now, you've got to make a record. You've got to file the proofs in front of the examiner before you appeal. But let's say you've had SRI do the research. You file everything you're going to rely on. You then say, this examiner is not acting reasonably. You file a notice of appeal. A little committee of three examiners are assembled, the supervisor, another examiner, and the examiner. And they sit down and they have a discussion whether the examiner is wrong in forcing you into an appeal. So if the three of them can't agree, I don't know what happens. If they agree that you get another bite of the apple, and they'll give you half a loaf, they'll tell you that, and you withdraw the finality. Or they'll say, no, the finality is not withdrawn. You filed a notice of appeal within 2 months, extendable by 4 months. You file a brief on appeal. God help you, $10,000 document. And by the way, if you don't meet your deadlines, you're out. You're going to the Board of Appeals in the Patent Office. You can report for me. That's why we're having you here. Tell us what the experience is.
Well, actually, at MIT, we filed a number of patents and won in the Board of Appeals. I have more than a dozen patents, and we won in the Board of Appeals twice, but not in cold fusion. In cold fusion, they tend to rubber stamp whatever the examiner says. So if the examiner misdescribes the application, they don't even care. As an example, the one I sent you, the one that's before the Board of Patent Appeals now, was a way to measure loading by vibration of the electrode. Excess heat was never measured, never mentioned in the application. And yet it was mentioned in the denial. It was mentioned in the Board of the Patent Appeal decision. It was mentioned 37 times in the Board of Patent Appeal and that often in the patent application. Yet was vibration mentioned in the Board of Patent Appeal? No. Was the measurement of loading, which is what the patent was about, mentioned? No. All they said was, this is what Fleischmann and Pons did.
Okay, so the issue is not what Fleischmann and Pons did. The examiner is supposed to raise the issue of doubt. After that, it's up to you to being filed to SRI. The Board of Appeals is supposed to make the decision that should have been made by the examiner. If you don't like their decision, if they turn you down, going to the Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit is not a happy state of affairs. They do not reconsider the case. They only evaluate whether there was a basis for the decision in the Board of Appeals. Is there a basis? Could the ruling that they made have been based upon what was filed? So you do not have much hope before the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, and you have virtually no hope of applying to the Supreme Court, because it has to involve an issue of law of national importance. And the Supreme Court has complete discretion as to what they hear. And many cases that deserve to be heard, maybe on murder trials or something, they do have to hear it. But the Supreme Court has discretion to say this is not an important case. And that's why you get
you do
up.
Get power in the federal appellate court. If you lose in the Board of Patent Appeals, you have two choices. You can go to the D.C. Circuit, or you can go to the federal appellate court. If you go to the federal appellate court, you get subpoena power. When we gave a Dukas Tecumseh to the patent office, we found that they had deep-sixed the declarations that we submitted. We found that they had deep-sixed the publications we had submitted. And if we hadn't given them a Dukas Tecumseh with a subpoena, we never would have known.
And Mitchell sent me the index to the file at the patent office, and there were a bunch of documents that were entered with the number 33.5, 39.5. These are documents that have been, quote, found, and then entered out of order in the index. I don't know how to explain it. I find it hard to believe, but there's evidence that this is for the case of injustice.
Once the patent application is rejected, then all the content in the patent application becomes public knowledge.
Good question. The patent application is published after 18 months, the application. I don't think the file contents are published unless a patent issues. If a patent issues, everything is available to the public. Because in litigation, the defendant attorney will go back through the whole file. It's called the file wrapper. But the file wrapper doesn't mean the wrapper. It means all the papers inside. So the whole file wrapper is available to the public if the patent issues. I don't know for sure if you refuse the patent whether the file wrapper is available to the public. I don't know. Two questions more? Yes.
Could you tell me the difference between patent application and patent itself?
Yes. So a patent application is a request to the government to certify that you have an exclusive right to do something new. But you don't have a patent until the stamp is applied. Go ahead.
So if the patent application is granted, but the patent is not,
if the patent application is granted, it means there's a patent granted. So, and what you get is a folder with a gold seal. It used to have a blue ribbon. And a nice, it's a folder with a seal of the United States Patent Office. And inside is a printed copy of what you filed. You define your exclusive right. So when you open up the folder with the big seal on the front, inside is a copy of what you filed, printed by the printing office of the U.S. Patent Office. And it's on your neck if it's not written properly. And we're going to have one more question, and then I know we're all tired. I want to thank Mitchell.
Oh, Eric?
Or we can do whichever you want, tomorrow or today.
Maybe tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Thank you!
We're not going to have a meeting, but we've reserved a room if you want a breakout room. The Paul Revere room is available to anybody in this group. There's a series of tables.